Hello and welcome to Accelerating AI Ethics, the podcast of the Institute for Ethics in AI at the University of Oxford. I'm Dr. Caroline Green, and in each episode, we explore bold ideas, innovative research, and creative responses to the ethical challenges posed by artificial intelligence. Today's guest is one of our Accelerator Fellowship Program fellows, Angela Udur-Luganti, a Kenyan technologist, open source advocate, and executive director of Ushahidi. Welcome, Angela.
Thank you, Caroline.
She was also named a World Economic Forum Young Global Leader in 2024 and a Mozilla 2024 Rise 25 honoree for championing the need for building inclusive AI systems. It's really great to have you with us.
Thank you so much.
You're spending the week at Oxford.
Yes, I am.
This is the second podcast that we are recording together.
Yes.
The first time it was with Dr. Joy
in Nairobi.
In Nairobi, yes. Which was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, it really was a lot of fun.
And I think we'll be able to talk a little bit about the event then. Mm-hmm. But now I've got you here with me, and we've got this... half an hour or so to really focus on the work that you're doing as one of our senior fellows at the Accelerator Fellowship Program and, you know, all that great new ideas that you've got. But first of all, before we talk about, you know, your work and your project, I'd like to get to know you better as a person, mm-hmm. What drives you. Mm-hmm. So can you tell me a little bit about your history?
Okay. Angela Udur-Luganti. Fun fact, I was born in Ukraine. I was not born in Nairobi, Kenya, which is where I live. I come from a family with strong roots in engineering. Both my mom and my dad are engineers, which is why they were in the USSR at the time when I was born in Odessa. And I think a lot of my passion for math and engineering really came from them. I really do look up to them. Both of them are currently retired, but they really did set the tone for what it looks like to really apply your hands-on skills to solve problems. I do have a software engineering background. I am trained as a software developer, even though I have not touched a line of code in years. And I guess you... The way my career has kind of progressed is driven by who I am as a person. Yes, I love solving problems. I love putting two and two together and seeing how those fit come and create a bigger thing. But then there's also a strong passion for how that then applies in the real world. And so even in my time as a software developer, I always found myself drawn to how is this work that I'm building helping people? So I was always acting as that bridge. And so naturally, as time has gone by, I really found myself applying my understanding of technology systems and thinking critically about how then it applies in the real world. How is it helping this person in the village, or how is it helping my mom or my dad or my kids? So I'm really driven by how we can leverage technology to do good in the world and how it can really help help people. And more recently, thinking about that particular challenge and narrowing down on the African continent, which is where I live, which is where my family is, and how we can then use that knowledge and use that application of technology to help us thrive and not survive.
Mm. Mm. So when I came to see you in Nairobi, mm-hmm. which was such a beautiful experience for me, some of the conversations we had there also revolved around women in tech.
Yes.
And girls in tech. And I know this is something that you're passionate about too, right?
Yes.
You're a mother of two daughters too, right?
Two amazing girls who will take over the world, yes.
So when you think about, you know, you and your girls, what is it that, you know, how are you talking to them about technology? Mm. How do you think, is there something that concerns you at the moment them growing? I've also got two girls, mm-hmm. and, you know, I often think about how technology can help them, shapes them, and also is a problem for them. So how do you see that?
So that, it's complicated. Like, I think about my own journey as well as someone who, as a woman in tech, and realizing that a lot of my journey was also shaped by how my parents brought me up, right? So... Here, as a woman and in a fairly patriarchal society, like this idea of having women in engineering always felt like it was odd, but my parents raised me not to think that I wasn't that I was capable of doing anything, like, right? Like leveraging my really excellent skills in math, and that I could do anything I wanted, that I should not be limited in my ability because of how I look. And I think it's just a confidence that helped me carry that throughout, whether I was in class or even in the jobs that I pursued. And so I've modeled a lot of that for my children as well, right? That they can do whatever they put their mind to, that it's really about what their drive and their passion is and the hard work that they put into it. And so that's constantly what I'm challenging them to do. I'm also well aware that the way my career is progressing will likely shape how theirs goes, regardless of what path they take, because mine was also shaped by my mom. She's an engineer, and she was a go-getter, very ambitious, and still managed to find a way to kind of ground herself in how she raised me. So that's the philosophy that I'm using. And when I think about how technology is evolving, I am more worried than I think my parents probably were. Yes, technology provides a lot of opportunities to shape how we think, to shape how we learn. But then there's also massive risks that it's exposing people to. When I think about the people who are online targeting young children and the kinds of content they're creating, and how do I protect my children from that? That's a question that I'm constantly carrying in my mind. How are these systems that are built going to see them? Right, you know, as African girls, you know, are they going to see them for who they are? Are they going to be exposed to biases? How is it shaping how they think as well? You know, right now I think there's a lot of debates. I saw this article recently that the UK just rolled out some rules on screen time for children, depending on their ages. How do we also navigate that? How do you navigate the opportunities it presents, but then also make sure that you're not overexposing them in a way that could limit their development in terms of their brains or even their critical thinking. So that keeps me up at night sometimes, and is probably one of the other reasons why I'm also doing this work, because I keep reminding myself and also reminding people out there that technology is not inherently good or bad. It's how people use it that determines its utility and whether it's good or bad. In many ways, it's a mirror of humanity. And so I look at it across three spectrums. Who's building the technology tools? And then how are those tools being used? And then how are they shaping how we behave? And currently, there's, at least when you look at artificial intelligence, there's a concentration of power around who's getting to build it. Which then also influences how it's getting used and its applications, depending on the resources that people have access to, and is also inadvertently shaping how we behave and how we think. And so my challenge is really thinking through, how do I build differently that will then encourage better use of the tool that will then shape a different way or a different set of behavior for the audiences that we serve. Mm.
Mm. So thanks for sharing all of that. And I think that that's a really beautiful bridge now into the work that you're doing. And so quite recently, you published a blog on the Accelerator Fellowship website at the Institute for Ethics and AI on open data. Mm-hmm. And one of the quotes in that blog is that you say, we need more representative data to make AI systems fairer, but collecting and sharing data can also deepen exploitation, inadvertently facilitating data extractivism. Mm-hmm. Help me to understand a bit more the two parts to that quote. How do you feel, and why do you feel we need more representative data, specifically in your context and from your work? Mm. And you know, the second part.
That's a very good question. And thanks again for giving me the space to share my raw thoughts on what openness in the age of AI really looks like. So, over the last couple of years, and I know that it's also a core part of the work that Dr. Joy does in exposing biases in AI systems. As someone who lives on the continent, I think it's a fairly well-known fact that data sets from the African continent represent probably maybe just slightly above 10%, maybe even less than that, of data sets that are being used to train AI systems. And so inadvertently, while, you know, one, we are trying to break through the barriers of how we can build AI systems that really reflect our lived realities, but the ones that exist that are out there that are much more pervasive of how penetrated the market still have significant gaps. Yes, there's work that's been done right now. If you're using Claude or using ChatGPT, it'll speak in Swahili, but will it really cover my language, Luo, or my girl's language, Luya, really well? And will they really be able to interact with it? And then thinking further into what risks are people then exposed to? And the work we've been doing at Ushahidi over the last 19 years has been trying to bridge that gap, in the sense that we've been trying to surface people's lived experiences to get decision makers to truly understand what's happening on the ground to then shape their decisions. So naturally the thought has been, okay, we have a certain type of data set that could help to open up perspectives on what communities on the African continent or communities that tend to get left out could look like. It could be a really good pipeline to help create representation, because again, it's coming from these local communities. So we're holding that part and saying, well and good. And then we think about how the ecosystem is growing and how things are moving about. And there's a question around, what exactly does open mean, right? There have been questions around what data is being used to train the AI systems that exist today. We have some assumptions around the data sets that are being used, but not explicit clarity. And I don't want to speculate on whether that's intentional or not. But there have been concerns that this data is being openly scraped from the web, right? And then being used to build proprietary systems with little to no value going back to the communities that helped to generate it, right? With the, you know, the traditional open source ecosystem, there was always this assumption of shared value. I am giving you my understanding of an issue, knowing that you will benefit from it and you will pass that on to other people. But it seems like there's a gate that's been created. And so, and for me as a person who may have given the original information, there's no pathway or agency to determine how it then gets through that door. So there isn't a shared value or a shared benefit going on. And this is the core of the challenge that I then shared there, which is, yes, we want to make data sets open to create representation, but if we open it without thought into what could happen, then we are exposing people to extractivism. Places where data is then just pulled out, value is created for a select few, and it doesn't go back. And that's one thing that we don't want to do. We need to think about how we open them up, but in a responsible and ethical way that truly gives agency to the people who've contributed to building that that body of knowledge, to continue sharing that around and also determine what value should come back to them.
Mm. So I've got two questions following on from that. The first one is, so with Ushahidi, you have built systems where you actually, you know, hear people's stories.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And now you're also thinking about how you can use, or whether you're going to open up that data. Can you help me understand first a little bit, what kind of stories do people share and how do they do that with your systems?
Thanks for that. So let me start from the very onset and just giving clarity into how exactly we help people tell those stories. So we are essentially the critical infrastructure for community intelligence, at least that's my firm belief. What we do is build technology systems that are open source that then enable local communities, civil society, NGOs, or decision makers to then use that to gather information or gather feedback from local communities. So practically speaking, it could be, say, a local council in a certain county in the UK that sets up an instance of Ushahidi. They configure different channels, could be text-based, could be smartphones, could be WhatsApp channels. Then the population shares those messages with them. They get pulled into our platform, and then the county government is then able to organize that data and make sense of it. So when I talk about there being 200,000 instances, that's what I mean. There are 200,000 counties or 200,000 civil society organizations that use our open source platform, configure channels that then enable them to engage with local populations at scale. And that is the core of what we have done over the last 19 years, really helping people everywhere to quickly gather community intelligence, aggregate it, and then try and make sense of it to then inform their decision. And that data is fully owned by those people setting up the instances. We intentionally did that from the very beginning because it was always agency by design, not just as a buzzword. And the thing we've done well is help people gather data and tell individual stories. So the county government in Siaya or a civil society organization in Nairobi might be working on climate, but they're each telling the story from their perspective. And what we are trying to do as we move along in this era of AI is help people move from telling singular stories into telling collective ones, right? We've had so many people come in and tell us, we know that you've worked with these communities around a particular issue, governance. What are you seeing? What are you learning across the region? And how should that shape our decision making on where we're putting in money or what policies need to be created? And so that's also another reason why we're trying to bring all of these data sets together to, one, create the representation in AI systems, but two, also see what we can learn when you put all of that information together and what stories can come out of it, while navigating the fact that each individual storyteller owns that data and trying to figure out what they would want in as far as governance around their data sets.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So just another procedural question I have.
Yes.
So as I think a lot of people who know me, my background a little bit, know that I work with older people and people living with disabilities and so on. Here in the community, in the UK mostly.
Yeah.
And we often see a digital divide here where people feel and just do not have access to, you know, or the whether it is actually the laptop that they, or the internet, or let alone they feel like they don't know how to use these kind of systems, they don't feel empowered, or they're worried because they're worried about scams and so on. So I'd just like to understand how, you know, you have seen people in your context engage with systems that are based on your on the systems that you've just spoken about.
Okay.
Is there a big digital divide here? Because surely that's also important, you know, whose data are we actually collecting?
Yeah, and I think it's the recognition of that digital divide that has actually shaped how we design the tool. From the very onset, if you listen even to the talks the founders and myself over the years have given, it's really always been about meeting audiences where they are, right? And really trying to identify what tools do they currently have access to, and how do we design our mechanisms of engagement around what they already have access to, rather than trying to create the newest shiny thing and trying to get them to use a tool that will have a bigger barrier of entry. And it's really helped us to expand the scope of how we engage. So SMS has always been the lowest hanging fruit. It's the most ubiquitous tool. Everybody can send a text message. And then for those in urban areas, smartphone applications, native ones on iOS or on Android. And if you can as well, say, use the web version where you can fill out a survey. That's how we've done it. And it worked really well in the first 17, 18 years. And then more recently, we've started to pick up signals from local communities. There's a lot of research fatigue. People are tired of, you know, field collectors or researchers going to the ground and asking them a fixed set of questions all the time, and it just being a repeatable cycle, right? And so we've started to question for ourselves as well, what does meeting people where they are in this age actually look like? In an age where, I mean, there's so much going on in the world, everybody's busy. And two, with the proliferation of AI as well, people are expecting things to move faster. I don't remember the last time I filled out a survey, to be quite honest. And even if I did, like, what was the motivation? Was it that it's because I know who this person is? And so what we are currently designing, this tool called Distant Voices, is also trying to reduce that friction. So that, like, say, for the older population, someone might not be able to send a text message, but they might be able to call in to using integrated voice recording. Or they might be able to send a voice note on WhatsApp, right? And allowing them to speak, not necessarily bombarding them with 10 questions based on what I think I want to know, but allowing myself to discover what it is that they are saying by allowing them just to share that in a frictionless way. And then we go and do all the work that needs to be done later. Figure out how we're going to leverage AI to do the translation, do the geolocation, do the classification, or at least extract that insight from what the message that is being shared, and then collectively put it together into a dashboard. That dashboard could look like a screen. It could look like a PDF. It could look like a policy brief. So our thinking around meeting people where they are, I think, is something that is constantly evolving, and we're constantly reevaluating that, just making sure we're engaging with people. We've had projects where we've worked with persons with disabilities in Kenya and in the African context, and are also using that feedback to shape that. So it's not a fixed model of use this particular tool. The strategy has always been try and go far and wide and find out where conversations are happening and then plug into that or innovate around that.
Okay, so this is super exciting to me. Yeah. First of all, I think, so as I understand, is inclusivity and data. You know, it's not just about the data and whose data it is. It's also how we collect the data, what happens to it once it's collected. Mm-hmm. And surely also, you know, people want to see, I wonder whether that research fatigue also comes from the fact that maybe at the end, you know, people take this time, they fill in a survey or write a text message, but in the end, they're like, okay, what happened? You know, my bin collection still doesn't work, or, you know, I'm still seeing something much worse even in my life. So I've shared my voice, but it's not making an impact.
It's not making an impact. And also, like, what's the feedback? Like, what came out of me sharing this information with you? Where did it go? And who's gaining access to it afterwards? So that feedback loop as well is a really big question, and something that we've also heard from other partners around who've also been engaging with local communities. They're asking themselves this question around, yes, how do we reduce the friction of engagement, but how do we bring it back and explicitly? Yes, we know that getting to policy change is something that takes much more time and is harder, but surely there's something in between there that can still go back to say, okay, we might not have been able to get your MP to do something different, but here's what we then presented to them based on what you shared earlier. And so that's also a critical piece that we are thinking about and trying to be intentional about how we design it. I think previously with other versions of the platform we've built, we had SMS alerts as a way of sending it back, being like, okay, you can determine what region you're in and you can get updates, but trying to be more intentional around what more could we tell. So say we had 15 people from a community say this, we've identified this as a challenge, and here's the next steps around how we'll continue with that and start to also work with our partners to ingrain that as a process.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Okay. Yeah. So going back though to the data.
Yes.
Which is the beating heart of your work.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
And so I remember for our first podcast recording with Dr. Joy Bulawini, she said that data is destiny.
Yes.
And this is something that you said, you know, touched you and you picked it up in the blog too.
Yes.
Let's just explore that a bit more.
Okay.
How did you understand that? What does it mean to you?
It was, if anything, it happened even before the podcast. It happened during the panel discussion, during the screening, while I was moderating the discussion between Dr. Joy and the other two panelists. And everyone has, like, in this new age, everyone says data is a new oil, data is a new currency. But her framing it as destiny was extremely powerful, just because you get to see how AI systems are shaping decisions and what it is doing. Things like the question on the jobs it is taking, right? The decisions that are getting made by law enforcement, or the decisions on diagnosis it really is destiny. And so the question I started to ask myself is, who gets to shape that destiny when you are left out of a training data set? What happens to your destiny? Or when you have no choice in determining who accesses what data, right? You go to a hospital and you give a lot of your information, right? But what rights are you giving away when you share that information? Do you understand how that data will get used in this moment? Do you understand how that data is going to get used in the future? Do you get to have a say in how it is used, knowing that there will be certain decisions that will be made as a result of the information that you've shared? And so part of the work that I'm trying to do with the fellowship is answer those questions. How do we design models of governance that will allow people to determine what data they're sharing, which we're trying, there's some progress being made there, but who gets to use it? How do they get to use it? What are the guardrails? What are the limitations of use? And how also does that get enforced? And who's enforcing it? So that those really are the big questions that I'm asking myself. And we hosted a workshop just a few days ago at the Schwarzman Center with some legal practitioners. We had some AI researchers in the room. We had people working in close proximity with these local communities, a few others that have been working as data stewards in the room, and tried to really map out what potential governance models would look like. And I know that it's a challenge that is not unique to just us as Ushahidi. There's many people struggling with this challenge as well. But my hope is that in convening these conversations, we are not only learning how we can do or how we can shape that governance model responsibly for the Ushahidi ecosystem, but potentially develop a framework that can help others who are also dealing with this challenge.
I see a really close connections also with your work and some of the work that's going on within the Institute otherwise. So Carissa Felice, my colleague, she just published her book Prophecy, which is all about how, data people who are building these AI systems are through prediction, actually determining the future, really. And that type of power, what to do about that. So I think that, I think links to some of what you have just said and some of your key concerns there. And then the work that I'm doing with Ambassador Audrey Tang, the Civic AI framework, which is all about how do we use AI systems for the benefit of relational health within communities, within families, in societies, using AI and all of that's available, actually, to hear what it is that people, what people's experiences are, to shape systems that will actually help them in the moment for whatever it is that we're building them for. So I'm really excited to also explore with you in the future, how we might work together here. Tell me a little bit more about that workshop at the Schwarzman Center for the Humanities a couple of days ago. What were some of the key lessons that you're taking away from that day?
Okay, so this is the first of a series of workshops that I'm hoping to host in the lead up to a penultimate event that we're calling the Data Commons Summit in October, potentially at the Schwarzman Center for Humanities. And it was the first workshop to kind of ground us in, one just collectively framing what the challenge is and starting to see what questions might be emerging around existing governance models, and then using that learning to shape how we then go deeper into some of those questions in a series of workshops after. So we ran three very interesting exercises, one of which was just trying to get us into the frame of five different personas in the room. So we had the local communities from whom we'd be gathering that data or that knowledge from. Then we had funders and policymakers, people who'd be making decisions or shaping the kind of regulation around it. Then we had data stewards, people like ourselves as Ushahidi, who have been helping to collect that data at scale and are probably responsible for ensuring it's not being used in the wrong way. Then we had AI researchers and developers and lawyers in the room. We tried as much as possible to get that general representation. I think we did okay. So the first exercise was, okay, trying to identify what are the key questions in everybody's mind around this issue from everyone. What are their red lines? What are their no-go zones? What are their concerns or what are their fears? And I think the prompt was the three issues that are top of mind and one concern for everyone. And it was interesting to see that there were a lot of questions around enforceability of whatever governance model. There were questions on who should be the deciding factor or where exactly power lies, with some undertones of trust and accountability being the strongest ones across the board for everyone. Then we went into a second exercise. A second exercise of then looking at five existing licensing models, looking at what Creative Commons has developed, one in the middle around what a data trust could potentially look like, one with, you know, tiered access, saying, say, raw data is not accessible, but you then have access to insights, and a community governance model. And I walked in thinking that all these groups would probably lean more towards a community governance model. And I was shocked. There were more questions around that than answers and convergence. It seemed like people were leaning more towards, okay, identify an individual that we trust to then be the one who is responsible for governing whatever it is that is holding the data on our behalf. I'm not saying that is a solution. That is what the group of people in the room landed on. And the light bulb moment for me was realizing that each of these different tiers of stakeholders are speaking in echo chambers. Every one of us is only talking to ourselves. Researchers only talking to researchers, potentially engaging with policymakers. But I don't know how much there has ever been around getting everyone who's dealing with this challenge in the room to try and surface what questions everyone has to try and converge on a particular model. Everyone is working alone and everybody's convinced this is what will work for me. And I think there's more to be done to get us thinking about what will work for the common good. What does a common good actually look like for all of us? So I'm really looking forward to having more of these conversations and find that there's a unique opportunity for Shahidi to also try and get us to a point of convergence, or at least, again, like I said earlier, get us to a shared framework that many of us can agree on. We might not ever get to complete agreement. We're also well aware that different licensing models might be the pathway to go depending on the type of data that you are working with, but at least ensuring that every single person's perspective is being taken into account is really important. Because even looking at the questions that were coming up, all of them were valid. For AI researchers and the people who are building, I think maybe the other big lesson there is that there's a lot of mistrust. There isn't benefit of doubt around why is this person trying to do this. And it might be potentially because of who's been building and the way it's been built before. But when I'm engaging with an AI developer or a researcher and we're dealing with the same issue, I'm assuming that we're sharing the same value in. We want to see impact. So when that developer comes and says, if you use this model, it blocks me from accessing the thing I need to build for you, right? And then a lawyer will also come and say, I see your perspective on using this particular model, but I don't know how to enforce that. So how do we approach those questions with curiosity and empathy and try and address those while centering the local communities who are the ones who will be worst affected at the core of it?
You know, these are questions that I have just been grappling with, exactly those very human questions of where, in principles, first of all, it's already great when you can actually get different people in a room talking, right?
Yeah.
But then to address these sentiments, these assumptions, these biases also that people have towards each other. Mm. So the reason why I'm, you know, this really resonates with me, what you've just said. It's because I've just concluded, I'm in the midst, not concluding actually, this is an ongoing commitment for me, doing a co-production piece of work, we call it. It's a sort of philosophy on working with people in the care community, bringing people who are drawing on care and support, care workers, care providers, tech providers, policymakers, and so on, around the table to, you know, create first of all, what responsible AI in theory looks like, but also good practice understanding. And we did an evaluation and, you know, listening a lot to people's experiences who've been part of this work in the past year and a half or so. And even though we managed to get people in the room together, there are these issues of, you know, some people just not trusting tech providers. They're saying, but you're here, but you're only doing it for the money. You know, because marketing purposes or because you want our data for free, you're not actually here because you're really interested in making something beneficial for us and for society. And so when you ask these groups who feel that way, it's like, well, what will help you to trust
the other person?
It's incredibly, you know, and then the other side too is saying, well, actually, I'm just sitting here just listening to, you know, people whose voices are usually not heard. So I'm just going to listen to them, but I'm not going to say much or contribute much. And the reasons for that, you know, I can only, I've got a hypothesis of what the reasons are for these, but I think from a human point of view, there might be an issue of fear sometimes there to you, or, you know, care providers often also feel, some of the people who've opened up to me say, well, you know, these AI tools are actually really helping us. And we're under a lot of pressure with all this administrative stuff that we have to do. And if now we feel like we're not allowed to use them anymore because, you know, other people feel like this is unfair, it's just creating these huge barriers for us when actually it's helped. So I think that, you know, what you just said about how do people listening, how do they learn to listen to each other? And I think finding compromises too, right?
Because when you win, you lose. In this, whatever it is that's going on now, when you win, you lose. What does it look like to have, like, sometimes you'll have to give, sometimes you take. It really is a give and take. And I guess I'm also grappling with that. It takes me back to the thing that I said before. It's technology is a mirror of humanity. And it's because we're losing our humanity that we're then having all of these different struggles, right? Like, what does it look like to walk into a room and I will hear you not to respond, but to really understand what your perspective is and be open to seeing a different side to then shape how I then show up? It doesn't mean that we're always going to get to a point of agreement, but getting that little insight can shape a different way of how I then show up. And I wonder whether part of what has also been missing is the people who are being affected. You know, in the African context, you always talk about when two cows are fighting, the grass is the one that's getting hurt. And in this case, the grass is, like you're saying, the care community, the ones who are supposed to be leveraging these AI tools, they are completely missing in this conversation. Right? One of the things in the earlier days, I think that also came up during our podcast, that we're not telling enough stories around how AI is also being used for good. The focus is largely around, like, who's the biggest power? Who's the one who's dominating the industry? Who's building? And the research is also amazing. And it's more of the people fighting against how it is currently being built. And we're not hearing enough from the people who actually need to use it to then center us. And in hindsight, when I look at the workshop, I wonder whether that was a thing that also helped, because the grounding force, so that we grounded it in a lived use case, and it was really centered on, here's a community that's being affected by this issue. They shared their feedback. How do we make sure that they are at the heart of this conversation?
I think that's really beautiful, that reflection. And just two points following on from that. The first one is, you know, even though I feel it's really important, there's a growing kind of literature out there for the general public that names issues of power. You know, we are all well aware of that now, of the power of these tech companies. But I sometimes also wonder of whether that narrative of, you know, people who are I think, seen as, you know, very like selfish, narcissistic, self-centered, with no interest in the common good. I think that that's also not helping, though, to, you know, it's actually also one of the root causes of why so many people are so distrusting of tech companies. And it creates a real difficulty to bring everybody in the room. And so even though I am all for naming power, I think we also need to be mindful of that, you know, what it actually does, and that there are maybe also some consequences here that make it harder.
That is an interesting reflection. And it's hard as someone who sometimes is on the other end trying to hold these systems accountable. But when you think about it, even in your own personal life, like if you come at me attacking me, my walls will come up and I'll be focused on being defensive, right? If we, something interesting that once came up in a conversation, in a leadership program actually, don't fight the person, fight the issue. And so how do we identify what the core problem is and tackle that? And right now we're fighting each other. We're not fighting the issue.
And that brings me to the second point. You know, you said, I think we are all fearful that we're losing our humanity. But what I always also find is that we're actually just reminding ourselves again what it means to be human.
Yeah.
You know, we are grappling with these massive problems right now, and we are coming together in rooms. And, you know, it was so lovely to see that group as well a few days ago. You know, people actually show up and they have a cup of coffee together and they start talking to each other. And, you know, maybe sometimes in, you know, my experience, they sometimes also start fighting, but at least, you know, we get them together, we talk about these things, we see these emotions, we see these issues. So this gives me hope. Is seeing actually people reminding, leaning into their humanity here together.
I agree. If anything, even as I said, it's a mirror, the tech mirrors humanity. The conversations I have been in over the last year and a half, and even how like we started from a technical perspective and we've landed on the human aspects, just reminds us, I think, the way things are evolving is really forcing us to identify what our red lines are, and reminding us what values we need to employ as we move along. So I'm much more hopeful. There's work to be done, but I'm much more hopeful in the sense that there's more of us thinking that way, thinking about how we show up as humans, thinking about how we can make sure that these systems do not take away from what defines humanity, even though there is a bit of resistance around that.
Mm-hmm. Mm. So I'm really excited to have you with us as
Thank you so much.
A while now. Mm-hmm. You already mentioned they're going to be running a series of workshops.
Yes.
Those will be...
Some will be virtual, some will be in person, but we will let everybody know. I think first step is trying to really digest what we learned to then help shape what the other workshops will look like. But we'll continue to share updates even on the AFP website and newsletter. But we have the penultimate event in October.
And I'm so looking forward to that.
Same here.
And all listeners will be able to, as you said, learn more about that in the coming month when they come to the Accelerator Fellowship Program website.
Yes.
So, Angela, I think this brings us to the end of the second podcast. I really enjoyed it.
Same here.
Thank you so much for taking the time. I know it's a super busy week for you here in Oxford.
No, thank you for hosting us. I really have felt welcome, and it's really an honor to be a part of this program.
Thank you so much. Mm. It's our honor.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. This has been the Accelerating AI Ethics podcast at the Institute for Ethics and AI at the University of Oxford. If you have enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and share. Until next time, thank you for listening.